This is Steve Heller with a Core 77 broadcast. Edwin Schlossberg has long dreamed of building an immense high-tech gaming arena smack in the middle of Times Square, where hundreds of people playing together at any given time would control power grids, move investments from one market to another, or build structures that revitalize urban spaces. If this sounds suspiciously like pop culture meets utopia, it's because Schlossberg believes that shared experiences, what we now call human interaction, will inspire cooperative relationships among strangers, and the stronger these bonds, the healthier the world. Along with a team of designers, inventors, psychologists, and interactors at ESI Design in New York, Schlossberg has been the driving force in creating everything public, from museums to exploratoriums, parks to recreational spaces, information kiosks to study centers, each built on a foundation of mutual reliance. Schlossberg was a pioneer of experience design long before the internet made the term popular. Among his projects are the American Family Immigration History Center at Ellis Island, the Pope John Paul Cultural Center in Washington, D.C., the Visitors Center at West Point, and the Sony Wonder Entertainment Project. He's currently in the process of developing the World Hunger Action Center in New York City, Infinity at NASA's Stennis Space Center, the Children's Museum of Los Angeles, and he just may be doing a museum devoted to ice cream and the economy. I caught up with him in his new office on Lower Fifth Avenue, where we talked about his thoughts about this brand new era of social networking and the generation gap it has curiously produced.
As long as I've known you, and before I knew you, you were involved in what we now call interactivity, human interface, human experience, experience design, but before there were these buzzwords. My question is, how has all of this coming now into the fore affected you, and how much of what you were doing going back 30 years affected it?
As you say, interactive or immersive, experiential, multi-voice, multi-channel, all those things that people now kind of put as the boundary conditions of what that idea is. I think that my instinct has always been that what I really love to do and what seems to be incredibly satisfying and interesting to me is to take subjects and experiences that people tend not to have, and definitely tend not to have with other people, and make them accessible. That, for me, has been the thing that kind of lights my life up. I love that. I have never been kind of specifically fascinated with making something look beautiful or making an object or a graphic or any one piece as the focus of my field of attention. I'm always thinking about how it would be picked up, attended to, what would get people talking to each other about it, what would make a difference in the environment in which it sat. How could we make it so that people would seamlessly think that the environment and the ideas gave them permission to be more excited, interested, and interesting in the world? That's what's thrilled me, always.
And where does this come from? I mean, this idea that people didn't have enough of this in their lives, or that there were experiences that were still out there to be experienced now that we had, you know, what McLuhan called the hot medium?
Right. I think that everyone, from my point of view, from how I see things, it seemed to me that what human, you know, so especially Western culture was really great at was perfecting the individual forming to the group. It seemed to me that that was what we had gotten fantastic at, that, you know, every once in a while better and worse, but that always the idea was is that someone was performing to a group. And part of that had to do with the whole idea about scarcity. There weren't enough resources to make everyone have a well-fed, good life. There weren't enough genetic opportunities to make sort of the freaks that artists are, or scientists or poets or politicians. And so the whole idea was about leadership and compelling arguments of individuals to groups. It seemed to me that as society got better at providing food, housing, clothing, and resources to everyone, and as we got smarter and got much more biological in the way that we organized life, that the group itself, the audience itself, needed to educate one another rather than always and only depending on the perfected individual.
This seems to come out of early to mid-century sensibility that there were too many people in power, totalitarian regimes, for example, that determined how pageants, how spectacles were going to go for manipulative purposes.
Right, and I think that, you know, growing up and hearing arguments for and against communism, for and against socialism, feeling that the promise of a democracy was always the power of the individual, but not the power of the individual over others, but the power of the individual to talk, to have the freedom to communicate and create things collectively, wasn't really being facilitated. What was being facilitated was places where individuals could talk to many people, rather than the individuals in a group could learn from one another, and so that the aspiration of a democratic society, of an educated population, would be realized. That it seemed to me impossible to ever get away from having new stories in which the basic functional relationship was the same, one person dominating the rest.
So it's not about control. I mean, even in the democracy, it's about control. There are laws,
yes.
There are restrictions, there are constrictions.
Right.
Now, you studied and worked with Buckminster Fuller. How did this affect your thinking?
Well, to me, he was the archetypal do as I say, do not as I do kind of person. He had this fantastic idea about how we needed to figure out a way to distribute food, clothing, and shelter to as many people as possible. But he felt at that time, and he came out of the 19th century great pirate idea, he was an archetypal great pirate. He had someone in his office count the number of people that had heard him speak. And he charted the number of lectures and the number of, you know, citations he got. And, you know, he was like an archetypal 19th century great pirate and a brilliant man. But he didn't have a structural model for transforming the situation so that it was really the collective experience of the idea and empowering everyone to do it rather than only him to do it. It was on his agenda. His agenda was, how can I communicate the idea that this has to stop? Which probably every individual who wants to be a leader of the world says to themselves, I want to be the one to change the dynamic. So I'm saying, I thought, I don't want to be the one to change the dynamic. I want to create a situation in which the dynamic can be changed by the people in it, mm-hmm. rather than me being the person who has to be always there in the sort of 19th century great pirate mode.
But you still have to set up an environment. Where do you draw the line in terms of that environment?
Right. The interesting thing is that human beings always have to do something in order to convey ideas. The question is, do you do it in the typical proscenium methodology, or do you try to create a situation which is facilitated by the random and excitement of the people who were there to experience it? So many things have happened, structural things that have happened, that have made it much more possible for everything that I'm thinking about to happen without me having to take any, clearly the internet, clearly wireless communication, clearly the, you know, mass distribution, clearly travel, all the things that have made people much more audience focused have been emerging. You know, those people, kids are talking and thinking actively about social networking and the opportunities for it.
This new age that we're living in, let's call it the social network age, because it really is the revolution.
It is.
Is this something that you anticipated? Is this something that comes as a surprise to you? Having worked in children's environments, children's museums, where basically you were dealing with the old, we won't even call them analog, you were dealing in situations where people actually had to use physical power to make things happen.
I find the opportunities now to be stunning and exhilarating. Much more, before it was always like, how can I do a little? And now it feels like so much is sort of being uncovered, and the opportunities become so cool that I'm thrilled by the things. I think I told you the story once, but I was part of SDS and at Columbia and trying to fight and go on a lot of fronts. And I met probably now 10 years ago Mark Rudd, and Mark Rudd said to me, who was the head of SDS at the time, and he is sort of a little lost, and he was driving around in a cab, a driving cab. He said, you know, I thought we fixed it. The goal of a living system is to stay alive. The goal of a machine is to produce a product. So machine thinking produces products and produces audiences and produces stuff. Biological systems are constantly interdependent, constantly changing, constantly evolving. The focus changes, the need changes, the weather changes. You know, everything is always good. So the idea of a really interesting experience is one that's designed to evolve and be able to be interdependently responsible for it. That human beings now run the Earth. Somewhere between now and, you know, 25 years ago, the human population became the controlling factor in the biomass. And so at that moment in time, it's our responsibility now to make sure that this thing doesn't tank. Well, in order to do that, you can't be standing at the top front of the group and talking. There's 6.5 billion people on Earth. The people need to be talking effectively to one another.
But effectively is the key. I mean, isn't there, for example, a lot of chaos on the internet? Isn't there,
right.
and chaos means that somebody's going to emerge that calls for order.
Right. And thing in the paper today about yet another attempt to control, to make algorithms to control communication between people and a whole group of people sort of emerging out to show that this is not possible. Because this is, in a living system, it's not possible to be at the front of the system. It's just not. And so the more these systems become living systems, and the more people have the expectation that it's not about, you know, a child growing up now isn't seeing only proscenium experiences. They're seeing all these interdependent experiences. And so they expect them. They expect that that's part of life. We didn't grow up thinking that. So therefore, I'm a freak from a long time ago thinking that this was possible.
Well, we grew up thinking of the genius principle. There was one person
Definitely.
Who created
Definitely.
An invention, Edison or
yeah.
whomever. And does that mean there'll be no more Edisons?
No. In fact, the great thing is that there'll be ever more Edisons, probably not at the kind of, they won't be mythologized anymore because they'll be collaborative. As you know, a thing you've heard me say too many times probably, but you read any major science magazine and there's 60 or 80 or 100 people in the lab that makes the discovery. There isn't one person anymore. That's over. And so we don't know how to celebrate greatness when it comes in a collaborative, collective experience. We have no idea how to do that. You can't, you know, the idea that Nobel Prize would be awarded to 350 people, it just seems, you know, not possible.
Although they've done that with the Pulitzer.
Yeah, but I think that we have to start thinking that way. We have to start rewarding collective genius rather than individual genius. It's not the same story. It isn't like, and so Steve, here's your prize for being the smartest person on Earth. It's fantastic the way this group worked. And how do you reward a group for working? Do you give it a prize at an award ceremony, or do you do something different? I think we constantly have to think about how to reward collective and collaborative excellence. That's a huge problem now, or a huge opportunity now.
In terms of what you've done in the past, as I mentioned, children's environments, you've also done retail environments, you've also done museums, you've also done the Ellis Island environment, which brings us closer to our past and closer to our roots. What important change has occurred for you and in terms of your methodology since the new technologies have arisen?
All these technologies that are effective are communication technologies. And what makes them really more valuable as they emerge is the idea that a single point of view, a single language, a single way of describing something, a single discipline being the filter through which the ideas are greeted, you can't do it anymore. When I teach, often one of the assignments I give to people is I show a slide of a forest, and I say, okay, well, everyone in the room is going to describe this, but you have to use a different way of describing it each time. Some people can describe it. So now, you know, we've done this thing in Tryon Palace where we have tours, and the lens of the tours are, Tryon was something, it was a building built by the English governor, then it was the place where the Constitution was signed, the Declaration of Independence, it became a site on the Underground Railroad, it, you know, so it the building kind of witnessed these changing structures. So we have tours given by all the different kinds of constituencies that were living there, rather than the typically, as you would, the Philippe de Montebello of the environment saying, this is it, or the one person. The one person's view is still essential, but it needs to always be packed with all this other. You know, as you know, the modern has done this thing where you have people who, there are like 10 or 15 different podcasts for the view of a show. The interesting thing about that is the emergence of that, and then the idea, thinking about how that is greeted by a 8-year-old child who walks into the museum and realizes that they can choose, for the first time, a way to look at what they're seeing. So there, that becomes normal. So the idea of normal, you know, we all are looking that the normal starts to be more inclusive and more valuable. So when you hear people talk, for example, about 6.6 billion people on Earth, there is always a somewhat of a, oh my God, there's just too many of them. Well, no. See, the issue is it's because you're not seeing them as seeing everyone as an opportunity for greatness. In other words, the smarter, healthier, stronger, more creative people are, they're not competing for your gig. They're actually possibly making the world a much more interesting creative place, rather than thinking of it as only a negative.
Well, you're also talking ideally that everyone in the world, on the planet, would be free to express themselves, which of course doesn't happen because of cultural and religious and all sorts of
mechanisms. Because we evaluate and we say someone who's living in a poor environment or perceived to be a poor environment is having a poor life. I have no view that that's true. I think that the idea is providing the access for more people to be working with other people there in their place provides a richer model, and so the opportunities are greater.
You talk about living environments,
yeah,
but you're creating environments very often that are there. A lot of money goes into them, so they're there for a good long time. Maybe not as long as a building,
right,
but they're there for a considerable amount of time. How do you build in this growth?
The way we do it often is we make the people who come part of the storytelling, so that they're the opportunity of doing testimonials, of creating pieces of the experience that's there being created by the visitors rather than only by the people who are working on it in advance. That is a way. I think that, you know, if you look at massive multiplayer games now, you know, like EverQuest or Second Life or other things, what you see is that people have not only created their presence in the experience, but they've taken the whole world, made a duplicate copy of it, and they have created new worlds. So the there's something, I don't know, 750 modification, complete new EverQuest games being played now, in addition to all the different ways that people play some of the games. For me, the ideal physical environment would be like that, that people are taking it away and kind of reconfiguring it and experiencing it.
Like the holodeck on Star Trek.
Yeah. Not a new idea, but an idea that's challenging to realize.
What does this mean for history when there are so many stories being told? I often think of a scene in that wonderfully tawdry movie, The Time Machine, where Rod Taylor gets out of his time machine and he's, you know, hundreds of years into the future, and he goes into what was a museum that looks like the Natural History Museum, and he throws some circular, like a disc, on a table, and he hears the history. It's just a narrative. What does that do for history? I mean, that's a very clear historic, the vehicle is different from what we would have expected, but the narrative is...
Yeah. It does two things. One is that it throws more of the responsibility of what history is on an individual pouring through 10 different versions or 100 different versions. I mean, I know that you're particularly interested in certain subjects, and you've probably read a lot of books about those subjects, especially, you know, design, whatever. And so you've composed your kind of history, but you've always thought that there was the history. We have the assumption that there is the history, but we now, the more you learn about the history, you realize that it was flawed, single, you know, untextured, never discussed the important things. So I think that the idea of history is going to transform dramatically, not because no one's interested in it, but because it's going to need to be collaborative and multi-voice and multi-channel, and we're going to have to put it into a much more of a multimedia. In a way, if you look at Second Life, Second Life is a precursor, a very primitive precursor of what history is going to be like, which is the idea that you have a very large database environment in which keep adding facets to it to make it full.
Do you think there's a generation gap?
Oh, yeah.
What is it?
The generation gap is the idea that life is in real time. And it isn't really in real time for a lot of people, for a lot of kids, but it's much more realer time. You know, in other words, the idea that the culture is that you're somewhere on the spectrum of, you know, and the rich things are, you know, you gain your integrity by this idea of where you, how much you've really studied so that you know a lot of the principles that you're trying to voice and that you're trying to manifest, rather than thinking that in a certain way, life is in the present, and it's your degree of connectivity that makes you have an integrity. I think that that difference is spectacularly different from a generation. So a lot of people who won't get on the internet, although that's becoming fewer and fewer because they're, you know, they're boomers, and it's because they don't want a multi-level narrative of what life is. They want the narrative, and they want to cruise out with that idea.
It's very comforting.
It's familiar. We all like that. No one likes an unfamiliar, disturbing experience.
Are the projects you're working on now, like the World Action Hunger, Hunger Center and the Infinity at NASA, are you now looking at those in terms of what we were just talking about,
definitely,
this generation?
Yeah. The question really is how far I can push the envelope to make it as collaborative, as compositional, interdependent as an environment.
And what determines that?
I met a lot of people when I started working on the Children's Museum. I decided that I was going to go meet the sort of primary people who were thinking about children's learning and education, like Piaget and other people. And one of the things that I heard all the time was how angry all these people who had theoretical paradigms were about the fact that their paradigm wasn't the paradigm, and how bitter they were about it, rather than thinking that they had provided a faceted lens of great integrity on a very complex and moving subject. One of the things I think I've really delivered to all the people that we work with is I think it delivered the fact that when we open whatever facility we're designing, it's beginning, it's not finished. It's a huge difference. You know, in other words, that most institutional clients for sure think that they are designing something which will be finished the day it opens, and then everybody will experience it. But you need to make sure that everyone really thinks that what you're delivering on the day you open is the communication tool that keeps evolving and becomes richer because people are using it.
So it comes down to an enlightened client saying, I understand,
definitely,
this. And if they're not enlightened, they want that finished project and they want a bow on it.
So how far I can go on that spectrum, it depends on who is there. And if I can move it 50%, fantastic. If I can move it 5%, sometimes I have to deal with that.
What would you say to date is your most successful in terms of that ideal?
It is really interesting to me that about a month ago, if you can believe this, I didn't realize that you could do a Google search I wanted to do a Google search to find some information because I had just seen this fantastic site, We Feel Fine. And so I thought, well, I want to see if there's if on the blogs, people are responding to. It was when the Time Warner thing came out, and there was a lot of press about the work that I'd done. So instead of clicking news on the search tool on Google, I clicked blogs, and there were some staggering number of Google hits on my name on blogs, and 90% of them were about one sentence that I said, which I had no idea, which was, I think, the responsibility of a writer is to create a context in which other people can think. I have to tell you, I don't know where I wrote that. I do not know where that comes from. But there were just an inordinate number of things about that in there. And I thought, how great. Someone asked me a similar question once, and I said, well, you know, the interesting thing is I don't know whether it's going to be the pocket calculator game book or something that I just did in an offhand way that has really moved the needle further. Because if you think purposefully that this is the thing, I think the chances of it being true are zero. because life is so complicated, and the opportunities of people picking up on stuff is so rich now that you just have to kind of wing it. You just do what you think is the best thing that you can do, and if people pay attention to you, it's fantastic. If they don't, it's the great thing is you don't know. And so that sentence, I love that sentence. It's completely true to what I think about things. I'm delighted that it's out there all the time. I did nothing to make that happen except write it.
That was Ed Schlossberg, and this was Steve Heller with Core 77 Broadcast.